So good evening. We had some connection problems here, but I'm here.
Hi.
How are you? So. Well, good evening. It's Sunday night.
Hi, how are you?
And that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John and Mac radio show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen, John Mac to some. Welcome you to the 181st episode of the weekly John Mac radio show. The recordings for the previous 180 shows may be found at www.johnmac13.com under the radio show tab. And John Mac is J-O-H-N, M-A-C, 13, at johnmac.com. I just had some difficulty logging in tonight, probably due to the cold in the Northeast, and I was just able to get in that, but I have not yet spoken to my guest, but I will get to her in a moment. As I've said for the last 5.5 months, my last piece for the West of the Guardian, the 212th, is still available. After more than 4 months at the at www.westoftheguardian.com, that's West of the Guardian, WestoftheGuardian.com. It was hopefully left up there to be read by every living American, and I, of course, hope that they do. It is the last of the Great Disruption series, as the paper, after the September 29th issue, unfortunately joined the ranks of the New York Herald Tribune, the Washington Star, the New York Journal American, and the Brooklyn Eagle in the graveyard of newspapers. The issue up there also contains columns by ex-congressperson and vice chair of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton, and critic John Simon. In addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newspaper at my web home. The newspaper is a curation of news articles from around the country and the world, articles relating to writing, politics, sports, books, the environment, and technology. Try and subscribe, only one email per day, and it's free. That's, once again, www.johnmac13.com. But I hope you'll join us not only tonight and next week when my guest is Arkansas-based video producer and the owner of Forbidden Tears production, Jennifer Dawn, but every week at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And now to this show, the 181st, as I mentioned. Callers may call in at any time during the show by dialing 646-716-9756. And that's 646-716-9756. But I usually hold callers until near the end of my interview with my guest. My guest tonight is college professor and poet laureate of the state of Missouri, Daliki Kika Barnstone. And I'm not pronouncing her name with the pronunciation that should, that she will correct me as soon as I bring her on, I'm sure. Kika actually does much more in her portfolio than what I just mentioned and discuss all aspects of her interesting life on tonight's John Mac Radio Show. Good evening, Kiki. Welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
I apologize for the confusion, but we had some real problems getting on from the studio tonight. So
no problem.
Well, although I gave the brief introduction to your life in the lead into the program, there is much to discuss as we flesh out the details. So let's start at the beginning. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Bloomington, Indiana. And then every summer we went to Vermont, which was a very formative, important time for my whole family. We We didn't have any TV or phone because my mother wanted us to be in nature and to be creative. She did bring along, however, her portable dishwasher, which we pulled in a trailer behind our car because she said that she would never get any painting done if she had to wash all the dishes. So my mother is a painter and my father's a poet. And we live nearby, for Vermont anyway, we live nearby Ruth Stone, who's a longtime family friend, and her daughters. And so we'd all get together and play the poetry game, all the kids, all the grown-ups. And so we played in the fields, and we hiked, and we played cards and checkers and chess and drew and made up plays and made costumes for the plays and wrote poetry. And it was quite idyllic.
So you were exposed to the arts, obviously, as a very young child. Were you interested in writing for as long as you can remember?
I mean, my first book of poems was published when I was 12. So there's The Real Tin Flower with an introduction by Anne Sexton. And so we were immersed in the arts. And so I was privileged in that sense. Most people don't have that much encouragement. There were other things in my childhood that weren't as wonderful, but that aspect of my childhood certainly did contribute to, I think, all three of us having a very strong sense of self and being easily entertained, because when you can make something, you can be entertained. You don't have to do other, you know, you can just, if you have a notebook and your imagination, that's all you really need.
Where'd you go to early school?
Tennis helps. I went to public school in Bloomington, Indiana, and I had a wonderful teacher named Mrs. McMillan, who didn't have the arts when she was a little girl in her elementary school. So she wanted us to have that. And so she had us painting and writing poetry. And one of the things that she had us do was write a poem about a color. And so I took off with that, and I wrote many poems about colors because, well, my mother is a painter and I do some visual art myself. So colors were just exactly what just my imagination was inspired by that. And so I wrote Blue is Grease, and that was my first publication, which came out in Poetry Magazine, a journal I've never been able to break into since, but maybe one day again.
How did you happen to have the book published at 12? Then how did you happen to get the late and great M. Sexton to do the forward?
Well, my father took the book to the editors at Macmillan, and they were very impressed. My dad tells the story that the editor, whose name I can't remember, put his head on the desk and said, "Willis, we should just give up." And so they published my book. It was the 60s, I think, and there was a lot of openness. That might have been part of it. So that's what happened. And then Anne Sexton, this shows my age. So the publisher originally asked Marianne Moore to write the introduction, but Marianne Moore was quite elderly at that point and said that she didn't really have the energy. So they turned to Anne Sexton and she wrote it.
Marianne Moore was very known in New York earlier than that because she was one of the number one Brooklyn Dodger fans baseball.
She's so famous for her baseball fandom. So that was those were the beginnings of my poetry career. I did, you know, when I was a kid, I felt I was very shy. So, you know, even now talking about all this brings back that little girl who didn't want to be, you know, didn't really want to be noticed as particularly different from other kids. So I have in recent years, I've been claiming this as my own. And it's been important to me as Poet Laureate of Missouri because I have a dual mission. One is to celebrate the diversity of the state, which is actually quite diverse, especially in Kansas City and St. Louis, and also to bring poetry to kids K through 12. And so having been a child poet myself, I think I have a special insight into what the arts can give to kids. And so now I'm sort of saying, okay, little girl, that was then and this is now. So go ahead.
You mentioned you were very shy as a child. Did you have friends in then grammar school that were also into the creative arts, or were you more or less of a loner because of your experience?
Well, I'm trying to be diplomatic here. Maybe I should just not be diplomatic. You know, Bloomington is like any university town, like, you know, Columbia, Missouri, where I live, or Ann Arbor, or Madison, you know, these big university towns in the Midwest. I think Ithaca is kind of like that, but that's not a public school. And so there was in my home, there was a lot of, my father is a retired professor of comparative literature. So we had people speaking all different languages in our home, and we had incredible diversity in our home. But then in the world where I was when I was a child, I was in the first grade in 1962, and so there was de facto segregation in Bloomington. And so, I mean, I was told that I was going to go to hell for not going to church on Sundays. And so, and, you know, my mother spoke with an accent. She's Greek. She's Greek Orthodox Christian, born in Greece, survivor of World War II, and my dad's Jewish. And so it was a little, you know, there was a split. I was very comfortable at home, but there were ways in which being a child in that environment, in a place where there were still covenants on the book that forbade Jews and blacks from living in the neighborhood where we moved. There are still in my mind and my heart of hearts, there are scars from that. But on the other hand, I did have very close friends, a few close friends. And then as I grew older, I became more and more comfortable. And, you know, by the time I got to high school, I had a lot of friends and was very blessed in that sense. But the funny thing about it is that those kids that I went to elementary school, a lot of those people who are now in their 60s are still my friends, and I feel very connected to them. So that's another thing about how your perceptions change as you grow older and how communities change as they develop. Because I was fortunate in so far as I started first grade in Bloomington when we moved there from Connecticut, and then graduated from high school in Bloomington. And so these are people that I was a 6-year-old with, and then I was an 18-year-old with, and we grew up together. And so that people change and people develop and culture develops. And so too has my relationship with the people I grew up with. So
I'm still very, very close to people that I grew up with in my neighborhood, New York City. As a matter of fact, even though they're spread across the country, some have been guests on the show. I saw in your bio, though, that you also went to the Ursuline Academy in Athens.
In Greece.
Was that after high school?
No. We spent 1 year when my dad was a visiting professor at University of California, Riverside. And then the following year, we spent in Greece. And I went to, though we're not Roman Catholic, I went to the Catholic school, which was actually a kind of turning point for me because the nuns were very kind and also quite strict. But I loved a lot of the things that they taught us. I loved sentence diagramming when I was in the eighth grade. And I loved the fact that we wrote with those Schaefer fountain pens and that our handwriting mattered. I loved the reading, and I even loved the theology in the morning, even though I didn't exactly, the children I went to school with, most of them had been raised Catholic, so they understood the theology, but I didn't know anything. I had a very positive experience at the Ursuline Academy. I kind of let go of my shyness at that point. I felt comfortable with my peers for the first time in my life. And so it was strange because a lot of people go to Catholic schools. I taught at two Catholic universities. And so I sort of have a sense of the various dynamics of it. And most people are very appreciative of the thought and the education they got at Catholic schools. And then there's also some, kind of residue, like anger at the strict sexual mores, for example, just to pick a random example. I didn't have any of that because I went there for eighth grade. I was a stranger to a lot of those dynamics, and I came away from it feeling very wonderful about the experience. So that's my little Catholic school year.
Two comments there. I'm the product of Catholic education, and I agree completely with you on the sexual mores. But many of my friends also went to Catholic schools, and even though many are non-believers now, they attribute their love of learning to their Catholic education. I also think, as a teacher who has read essays for 30 years, that one of the worst things that we ever did was eliminating the diagramming of sentences, because students now don't understand, or too many of them don't understand, the subject of that sentence. Need a subject, they need a verb, what's your feeling on diagramming?
Oh, I think, well, there are two things with respect to the penmanship, which people think is silly, and with respect to sentence diagramming. I think that you have, especially if you're a visual learner the way I am, I can still see those diagrams in my mind. I mean, it's not as though I'm in sentences as I write, but I understand how the sentence is formed, and that helps with, say, punctuation. And then with respect to handwriting, in many schools they don't teach cursive anymore, and there are a lot of studies that show that writing by hand is a different it helps you to synthesize knowledge, and that cursive is also important because you can write more quickly and more fluidly with cursive. So I ask my students to keep notebooks to try to write every day. I say it's unrealistic to think that you are going to write every day for the rest of your life, though you may. Some people do. But just for this semester, write every day. See what happens, and write by hand in a notebook. See what happens, even if it's just 10 minutes a day, even if you don't actually succeed in doing it, try. And it's remarkable what happens in my own life when I just say, okay, I'm going to write every day. And they say to me things like, writing every day has changed my life. I understand myself better. I can organize myself better. I know myself. And then one of my students said that the day he lost his notebook, he was hysterical as if he had lost his brain. So both of those things were really, the fact that I grew up in the 60s, so they learn cursive, but then that whole thing of carefully copying out your essay and trying to write neatly, those were important things that have served me and have helped me teach others. Not that I say have good penmanship, but for me, the pleasure of the pen on the page is very strong, and I think part of that is that I got that, I had that little moment where penmanship was so important. Anyway, you probably had the same thing if you grew up in a Catholic school.
Girl, I remember years ago when I interviewed the anti-war priest, Father Dan Berrigan, he pointed out that for prose, he used a computer. He was one of the early users of word processor. But for his poetry, he always wrote by hand, and he felt there are almost two different ways of thinking. I think so. I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, and I think that with respect to poetry and writing by hand, there was a little short period of time where I was drafting on the computer, and that was fine. But I find that I am more willing to write whatever when I write by hand, because it's just it's in a notebook. The notebook can be closed. It can be forgotten about. Whereas on the computer, there it is. You save the file. You can see how it looks in print rather than in script, and it sort of prevents you from doodling too much. I think it becomes much more formalized. And one of the things that I have in my life is that because I do keep my notebooks and do draft in pen, and I think that if I just write and nothing comes of that poem for a while, that's just fine. Because when I do have some free time, because I don't have that much free time to just delve into my notebooks, I have all of these ideas that I had completely forgotten about that can then spark something that can turn into something. And that's a great resource for a writer because, you know, sometimes you feel like you're having a dry spell. But if you have a stack of notebooks, then you can always go back into something and see what happens if that note that seemed insignificant at the time or that draft that you couldn't see how to make into something, suddenly you see, oh, this is how I can develop this idea. And it keeps you from being too precious about the creative process, about being too perfectionist about drafting, which prevents you from any kind of originality, to use a word that I don't quite believe in, but at any rate, you know what I mean. To be inventive, if you're too self-conscious, you can't be inventive. The self-consciousness comes later, but anyway. So
I after high school, then what happened?
Oh, well, then after that, I went to Brown University, and I spent, I had some wonderful teachers. I had Edwin Honig, who was incredibly sweet and generous and patient and looked at my work. And I had Michael Harper, who scared me, but totally changed my life and introduced me to so many writers that weren't being read. At the time in the mid to late 70s, most of the writers that you read were white men, and Michael was black, and so he gave us such a range of writers to read. When I look back on it, it's kind of astonishing that the foresight he had. He had us reading Adrienne Rich and Derek Walcott and Shirley Williams and Sterling Brown and Robert Hayden and Seamus Heaney, and then he would Dolores Kendrick, and you know you kind of get the picture of Philip Levine. It was Elizabeth Bishop. It was just a range of contemporary poets who later went on to win Nobel Prizes and Pulitzer Prizes and are our most revered poets of the 20th century, or late 20th century. So he was a very important person in my life. And my advisor was Robert Scholes, who died in December, and I felt quite bereft about that. And Michael also died in 2016, and it's been a rough year and in so many ways. But I had a great education there, and I did take a year and a half off. My father and I edited a book of women poets from antiquity to now, which made quite a splash in 1980 when the first edition came out, and then in 1992 we did a second edition. But as I said, the canon was very different then, and so a women's anthology, an international women's anthology, was a necessity, and there really it still is the most comprehensive international anthology of women's poetry. So then I came back and finished my degree, and then after that I spent a year in Providence, kind of, and New York City, kind of bumping around trying to figure out what I was going to do with next. And then I went for my master's degree at Brown, and then I went to California and started the PhD program at University of California, Santa Cruz, which was lovely, but there wasn't really what I needed there. I knew I was going to write my dissertation on Emily Dickinson, and there wasn't anyone to study with. So I spent a year in Greece again trying to figure out how I should proceed, and then came back and was an exchange student at UC Berkeley, and I ended up getting my PhD there and writing my dissertation about Emily Dickinson, which later became my book.
You mentioned Greece again. Are you bilingual?
When I was a kid, I was bilingual. I'm always losing and regaining my Greek. It's hard to maintain a language when you don't hear people speaking it. And so when I'm in Greece, I start to think more in Greek, and I study, and my Greek comes back to me. And then when I come home, I think, okay, I'm going to study. And of course, I'm here not living in a place that has a significant Greek community. And so then it fades away. So it's there in the background, informing me and shaping me. Recently in my poetry, I've been using a lot of Greek words, I've been trying to address what it means to be part of the Greek diaspora, or to be part of any diaspora, to have a hyphenated identity and to have close ties to your motherland at the same time that you are not, I'm Greek and not quite Greek. You know, I'm not Greek American in the way that people who grew up in Greek communities, but really the culture stopped sort of whenever people immigrated in a certain way. And so I've been writing about misunderstandings. For example, the Greek word for lamb chops is paidakia, and the Greek word for little children, what everybody is a little child in Greece, is paidakia. So just messing up the vowel can turn children into lamb chops, which could be problematic if you're, or lamb chops into children. So if you're at a restaurant and you're, not me, I would never make this mistake, but somebody who's trying to order in Greek could order little children.
or as John Kennedy, or as John Kennedy mixed up the word for Berliner with a jelly donuts, supposedly. but I know that you've also done some translation work. Has that been from Greek to English, or is it the other way around, or another language?
No, it's from Greek to English, and so my mother has sort of served as my dictionary, and I can kind of work with a dictionary and get I can get myself a little draft, but I really need, you know, a native speaker. Many people who are translate from the Greek or from any language have an informant who can sort of say, that's not the word for, I wouldn't make that mistake, but that's not the word for children. That's little children. That's the word for lamb chops. So
the tangent there for a minute. If you're translating something, and if it's meant to rhyme, and it rhymes in Greek, and the English words don't, what do you do?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, my father Willis Barnstone and my brother Tony Barnstone are really virtuosos with translating form into form, sonnets into sonnets. The Kavafi does have, Kavafi's work is often in rhyme. And there has been at least one translation that tried to preserve that. There are poets who are more, I mean, maybe I just didn't try hard enough. There were a few poems where I thought that you really needed to have at least internal rhyme and so on. There was one poem in particular called The Enemies, which is about the way that old writers feel threatened by young writers, and young writers want to overturn the old writers. It's kind of like the Oedipal complex of writers which I think might be have a lot to do with men, less to do with women, but that's another story. And that poem was in rhyme, and I thought that it had to be, the poem would not have the same power unless you heard unless the meter and rhyme were similar to the meter and rhyme that Kavafi had written the poem in. But I kind of try to make the poems more internally rhyming than end rhyming, for example, although a lot of his poems do have end rhymes. My brother did an amazing translation, actually, and the poem Walls has rhymes that are actually homonyms. And so the word for luck is tihi, the word for wall is tihi. And he managed to translate the poem with rhymes that were the same rhyme, the same word, or it sounded like the same word. And it's just an absolutely brilliant translation. But I did not feel that was what I wanted to do. it was a good project for someone else, maybe my brother.
Before moving into teaching, you had a position with the state of Indiana. Tell us about that.
I had what?
A position with the state of Indiana.
Oh, that was years ago. That was my summer job one year. It was completely unrelated to anything I would do in the future, really. So I had a job with the Department of Economics, Division of Tourism, and I went around with three other young women in a van, what we now call an SUV, and we had these ridiculous uniforms, red pants and these tops that had that were like Andy Warhol images of Marilyn Monroe on them, very 70s. And we would go around to state parks and fairs, and we would have a booth, and we would serve Gatorade and hand out information about the state. So that was what I did on my summer vacation on my first year. I don't remember if it was, I think it was my first year, my first summer after my first year of college.
I had one of those after my sophomore year. I was with the whole gang of people, all male, who would stop cars on the highway to ask people where they were coming from, where they were going, what the purpose of the trip was. So roads could be built, and your college career, you began at Beloit College. Where is that?
No, I didn't. I was. You mean my teaching career?
My teaching
career began at Beloit College, and that's 50 miles south of Madison, Wisconsin. And so I was there for 1 year, and then the following year I was at Marquette University, one of the two Catholic universities where I've taught. And then I didn't have a job for a year, collected unemployment, wrote a book, Madly in Love. And then I got a job at Bucknell, where I taught for 5 years. And then I taught for 1 year. And then in between, I was writer in residence. Took a leave for one semester to be writer in residence at Villanova, the second Catholic university. And then I got a job at the University of South Dakota, which was not the place where I wanted to be. And then I got my job at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. And I was affiliated with UNLV for 8 years. In between, I had a sabbatical and a Fulbright. The job at UNLV was a fascinating job in many ways, but one of the ways in which it was particularly important for me was it's an international MFA program, which means that the students have to spend 6 weeks in a non-English-speaking country and do a translation. So, and they can also spend 2 years in residence at UNLV and then 2 years in the Peace Corps. So it's a unique program. And then after that, I got the job here, and I've been here ever since 2007. So that's
your
my
roles. During your career, you're at two basketball schools, Villanova, which is the current NCAA basketball champion, and UNLV, that's known by most people as the big basketball school. So
Yes, that's true. It's definitely true. And I grew up in a basketball town, Indiana University, and
sure.
Actually for a little while, Bobby Knight lived two doors down from us. So
I remember speaking to a friend of mine who was the chair of medieval studies at the University of Tennessee, and he was telling me how for a while they had the biggest football stadium in the country. They put an extension on, and they were bigger than Michigan, and then Michigan put an extension on. And he told me all how important that football is. And I said, well, doesn't that bother the academic people? And he said, what, are you crazy? If it wasn't for football, there wouldn't be a chair for medieval studies. And I said, oh, okay. So that brought big revenue in.
Yeah, I guess it does. Here, when we had our what turned out to be quite devastating, there was the concerned student 1950, where our African American students were protesting against the racism on campus. There have been quite a few really horrible racist incidents on campus. Not a couple, more than a couple. That sounds like two. It's many more than two. The football team, the demand was that the president of the university resign. And the football team decided to go on strike in support of the students who were protesting, to make a long story short. And this is a really big football school and football town. And so indeed, the chancellor and the president resigned, and Gary Pinkel, who was the coach, who was a winning coach, beloved coach, was forced to resign because he sided with his players.
We usually don't think of athletes on campus as being politically committed, other than the few at different colleges. I mean, Bill Walton at UCLA, but we normally don't think of that. That's encouraging that they're not a separate group, that they're part of the campus community.
Well, I don't know how much they are. I mean, I think that they are really separated from the athletes are. I mean, I haven't had athletes in my courses, which is kind of odd because at other university I've had athletes, but and so I'm not sure exactly what goes on there. Maybe it's because I'm in English and I don't teach comp and stuff like that. We had a little bit of glory because Michael Sam came out as gay after his career here, well, actually during his career here, and he was fully supported by the university, at least by the athletics department, and there are there's a program called You Can Play, which tries to support LGBTQ athletes. And the interesting thing about that, again, was that the football team fully supported their gay player. And the whole town actually turned out to support him when Westboro Baptist Church came to, you know, harass us as a result. So there were a few moments of real solidarity and glory, but then immediately afterwards, the Republican-led state legislature has been trying to punish the University of Missouri, which is the flagship school of the University of Missouri, and is also, by the way, the Citizens University. So when you cut off resources to the university, you're cutting off resources to the citizens of the state. When you try to diminish the research and the respect with which faculty are held, you are diminishing the university and making it so that a degree from here, as if they continue to diminish us and deprive us of resources, the degree will mean less and less and less. Of course, this is happening all over the country, where public education is being assaulted by the legislatures that fund them. So I think it's a national tragedy and travesty. So we got
what
from
was the
sports to what?
What was the reaction on campus to the racial problems outside of St. Louis? Were they supportive of it? Was there much action on campus during that time?
No. It's kind of a mixed response, you know. I mean, I think that what happened was that there was this sort of moment of victory, which was immediately followed by a shutting down of dissent, and which came, you know, I mean, or an attempt to shut down dissent on campus. So, for example, the legislature, I don't know if they, it's hard to keep track of what they succeed in doing and what they don't succeed in doing. They tried to pass a law that would make it illegal for the football players to go on strike, and they'd lose their scholarships. Who knows, you know, and so the response among the students was initially quite, when all over the country students demonstrated to support our campus, that was amazing, that kind of solidarity among students, was part of the Black Lives Matter movement, and then they just, you know, it was like they came down on us with an iron fist. And the immediately after the president and chancellor resigned, some blankety blank put something on Yik Yak that said, "Well, I like some of you white people on campus. Don't come to campus tomorrow because I'm going to shoot every black person on campus." And the university did not see fit to shut down the next day. What began with as kind of a victory full of possibility ended up becoming a campus full of very demoralized people.
Because Claire McCaskill.
Students,
go ahead.
Claire McCaskill, she hasn't intervened, but when it first happened, she expressed support for the students, which was remarkable. I think she's been somewhat quiet because she's looking toward 2018 and her reelection campaign. She's She's a very fascinating person. I have a great deal of respect for her. But we'll see. We'll see what happens. It truly breaks my heart. And that we are the United States in general, we have such incredible resources. We could be educating people at such high levels, and we do have world-class universities. But if you start to say to graduate faculty, well, you know, you need to teach introductory classes, which is what the graduate students should be teaching, because they're more enthusiastic about it, by the way. When I was a graduate student, I didn't resent teaching comp at the University of California. I thought that was great. I was teaching. That's what I wanted to do with my life. I was interacting with students. I didn't mind that I was correcting the same thing over and over again. You know, it was an adventure. So, that no more hiring, fewer graduate courses, across the board cuts. So what you end up doing is, you know, you have a major research university and you diminish its reputation by diminishing the resources available to the graduate faculty who are doing the research.
Right.
And I think that that it's what I mean. It is a systematic attempt to destroy public education so that the citizens of this country who do not have the resources to send their kids to private schools will be enslaved by lack of knowledge, which means they'll vote against their interests.
At the same time, though, in New York State, Governor Cuomo's come out with free tuition at the public, both the two-year colleges and the four-year colleges, and Bernie Sanders spoke during the campaign of free public tuition. So we seem to have the legislators cutting back in some states to almost punish the academic life, and we have other people speaking out against the horrors of student debt and wanting to have universal public education. So.
I think that for sure, K through 12 and preschool, we should have preschool included in public education. It shouldn't just be K through 12. But I don't agree that public universities and community. I think community colleges should be free, but I don't think that. I think that. There are people who can afford to pay tuition. They should be paying tuition. You know, rich people should not get a free card when it comes to paying for public education in any sense, right? They should be paying their taxes. They should be paying a higher rate of taxes. And so I agree with Hillary Clinton when she said, no, we're going to have free education for people up to a certain income level. And after that, they, you know, should be paying in. Because what happens, you know, it all sounds so good. But one of the things that happened when I was teaching at UNLV is they had this millennial student project, right? Where the state legislature passed this thing that if you had a B+ average or better, you would get a free education at the University of Nevada or any community college, right? So what happens? Well, the public schools aren't that good in Nevada. They get very poor rankings. So what happens is you have these B+ students, right? And they haven't been well prepared for college. and they don't pay any tuition. And so what ends up happening? The University of Nevada has to add remedial reading classes to the curriculum. That doesn't make any sense at all. So I think that people need to get their skill levels up. The purpose, the beautiful purpose of community college is that people get their I can't believe I'm talking about educational policy, but I think about it. Get their skill levels up, and then they come, to the university, and they're well prepared. And if we had so much better financial aid, then they would be able to go to college for free if they were if they came from a middle class background. But I just don't think that it makes any sense to not have rich people pay for public education.
That was the same thing that you just mentioned that happened years ago at the City College of New York, where they went to open enrollment, and before that, the college had defined academic reputation. Well, open enrollment forced them to add, as you mentioned, all these remedial courses, and the overall reputation of the school went down. People would take the remedial courses; they were dropping out after it, and it's only in about the last 15 years that they've pushed all remedial courses back to the two-year community colleges. So,
which makes so much more sense, right? Because is it fair? I mean, it's not that people should be able to take remedial courses. It's not that they're stupid, that they some people may be stupid, but that's another story. But most people are not stupid. And so they should have the chance to gain the skills so that they can go to college. And, really you're not doing people any favors when you just throw them, say, okay, here you are with people who are well prepared and you're in the same class with them. And then the professor, where do you teach? At what level do you teach? And then they get demoralized by the students who are well prepared. And it's really an unfair and demoralizing thing, I think, for people who don't have the privilege of having a good public education. Of course, everybody should have a good public education from preschool on, but we're not there yet. And given that we've been overthrown by fascists, it's going to be we're going to have to work really hard to restore public education in this country.
One of the problems that I saw teaching students who came from the New York City public schools was the whole social promotion. I had some very bright students who couldn't put together a sentence. They could speak well, but they couldn't write. And I know the debates going back and forth that if you leave students back, that you stigmatize them to themselves. If you push them ahead, they're not ready for higher education. I don't know what the answer is, but I would sure that we're doing something wrong. That's why I disliked the dropping of the diagramming of sentences. I felt
right.
That at least to be able to write a sentence. And
well, it also helps to read, it helps to read some essays. But I mean, it is difficult. I also think that there's a lot that you can do with regard to admissions. And then, there's all these other things that are going on. Like, for example, it's easier to get into out-of-state school, public schools, universities than it is in-state, because the in-state want the out-of-state students. So they, for example, certain campuses, the University of Illinois, you have to have a 3.9 in there in order to even make the cut of consideration. I mean, that's wrong too, right? That again, it's a citizens' university. and it's the citizens of the state's university. And so, you know, when admissions becomes what I think that that's desperate and a little corrupt. But you know, you wouldn't have this question about whether people are going to prepare or feel stigmatized if you just had admission standards. And most places do, but I mean, what I'm saying is, if someone doesn't get in to school and then to college at the university level, then there should also be, you know, really good counseling. Go to community college, get your skills up, get your skills together. Then when you go to college, you'll be prepared and you'll actually be able to excel.
Ivan meant that they were being pushed through high school and even grammar school where they felt it was stigmatized to students, and they just pushed them along, which is unfair to them when they graduate and they have to compete either in college or for getting the job, and they don't have the skills.
This is a question of support, right? Like, wouldn't it be nice if we had enough school counselors and psychologists that a child would not feel stigmatized for? I mean, I knew lots of people who did grades over again when I was a kid. They weren't.
Yeah.
I mean, it happened. Happened quite frequently. And now what people do is they, instead of sending their 4-year-old to kindergarten because, you know, their birthday is in November, they send their kid to kindergarten at age 6 when their birthday is in September. So then there's this other thing where, which I think is fine. I mean, I think that some children really suffer because they're not developmentally ready to, you know, be in kindergarten or first grade. It wears you out, doesn't it?
One last thing on the policy. Well, one of the reasons why the state universities go for out of state students is they pay a higher tuition and there's more money coming in.
And now, so I just did this Poetry Out Loud competition. I went to observe our finalists here in Missouri. And, you know, Poetry Out Loud is funded by the National Endowment for the Arts and then and the Poetry Foundation. And so I took the opportunity to talk about how important the arts are in schools and to, you know, sort of say, this is funded by the NEA. We need the NEA. We all need to be impressing upon people how many aspects of our cultural lives are shaped by the NEA and the NEH. Because I don't think people understand how this funding works. I think that people, for example, I don't know who knew where the funding for their child to be able to compete. The parents were absolutely delighted that their child was a finalist in this competition. But I also wonder, do they realize that their child would not have this transformative experience were it not for the National Endowment for the Arts? Do they realize that many of the music events and theater events and film events are funded by the NEA, and that the NEA also helps to fund, say, the Missouri Arts Council? So this is why, another reason why we young people need to have civics lessons. They need to understand how government works, and they need to understand that the things that you may take for granted in your community are things that would not exist did we not have these programs. So I'm trying to kind of, in my own small way, be an arts advocate in my role as poet laureate to encourage children and teenagers to write and to be protected from other social forces that might be destructive for them, because they have something that's only theirs. Nobody can take away your creativity. Only you can. I mean, people can. I mean, that's not entirely true, but nobody can take away your mind. They can lock you up for being creative, as many artists have, but this isn't going to happen to children. But they might be more interested if they wrote themselves, or if they painted themselves, or if they made films on their phones themselves in governments that do lock up artists and intellectuals, because they could then say, oh, that could be me. So this is my, I don't say that to, you know, I don't say that about people getting locked up, but, you know, it could be a conversation.
No, we could go
I'm trying. Yeah.
We can go all the way back to very young childhood. There'd be no Sesame Street if there wasn't the PBS. And you know,
no.
That was transformative with young children learning the alphabet, learning how to count, and doing things like that. And that was all because the public broadcasting company. And
yep.
They're trying to cut that. They're trying to cut NPR. They're trying to cut the NEH, the NEA. It's very depressing.
I know. It's really incredibly sad. We just have to keep on keeping on.
To get into some not as depressing subjects, I
know
that all during your teaching career that you've still been publishing poetry, 7 more books after the first one. At 12, as well as poems in magazines and journals. Could you take us through your publishing history?
Well, so after The Real Tin Flower, then when I was in college, I published Windows in Providence. Well, actually, it was just after I graduated from college, Windows in Providence, which came out with very small press. Nonetheless, it exists. And then there was a kind of a long, I was still publishing in journals and doing other things, editing and publishing articles and so on, and publishing individual poems. But I think that I felt when I was, after 1981, when Windows in Providence came out, that I wanted to figure out kind of who I was as a poet in a different sort of way, and sort of as an adult, I guess. I was an adult when Windows in Providence was published, but I was a very young person at that point, and so I just applied myself to finding what my voice might be. Which is kind of funny because my friend Cornelius Eady says, everything you want to know about a leaky, you can find in The Real Tin Flower. That's, you know, that's the source. But, and when I look at those poems, I say, oh, there are a lot of connections. There's a lot of things that I continue to write about, images that keep on coming back. But anyway, so then I published Madly in Love, and it was Carnegie Mellon, which recently came out as a Carnegie Mellon Classic Contemporary. It came out as a Classic Contemporary in 2014. And then after that was Wild With It, which came out in 2002. And then there was Blue Earth, which came out in 2004. And Then there was Dear God, Dear Dr. Heartbreak, which came out in 2009. And then there was Bright Body, which came out in 2011. And then my most recent book is Dwelling, which came out in 2016. And then in 2015, Red Dragonfly Press published a little chapbook of mine called Winter with Child, which I'm actually quite fond of. I'm thinking that chapbooks are really kind of lovely, sort of short books of poetry that it's kind of a different form, and I like it. I'm hoping to publish more of them.
They're all available on Amazon, I'm
they're
sure.
They're all available. Well, they're all anything is available on Amazon or on. I don't check Barnes and Noble or anything, but very often. But they're all available on even Windows in Providence. I think you can get on Amazon or at your local independent bookstore.
They're all dying around here.
I know. I know.
In addition to poetry, you're also a visual artist. Could you explain exactly what that is?
Well, when I was in college, I didn't know whether I wanted to be a poet or a painter, although I was both. And though I pursued a career in poetry, I've made visual art all my life, and I really love making visual art, and I hope this doesn't sound arrogant, but no matter what I make, I like it. I don't have the same relationship to it that I do to my poetry. I mean, you know, it's not that I don't realize that some of my visual art is more accomplished and more and better executed than other pieces. It's just that I get so much joy from it. And my husband, Craig, would say to me, you should publish your visual art in your books, because I do these very detailed fountain pen drawings. They're very... they're very, very detailed. I get a lot of joy from doing them. And I would always say, no, I don't want the visual art and the literary art to compete with each other. When we were talking about the cover of Dwelling, my publisher, Stanley Moss, who's an art dealer and knows from art, sent me a print of a William Blake print, and he said, do you want this for the cover of your book? And I wrote him back and I said, no, what do you think of these paintings? And I didn't say that, and there was nowhere on them, you know, my name wasn't on them in any way. And he really liked them. And so he said, well, send me some drawings too, because you're really, really good. And I'm going, oh, well, if Stanley says so, then I guess that's okay. And so Dwelling has a watercolor of mine on the cover and then drawings of mine inside. And then since then, a painting and a drawing of mine are on the cover of Elizabeth Cohen's book Bird Light, and there's a fourth and there are a lot of my drawings inside, and then another one of my watercolors is on the cover of Thomas Simmons' book, which is coming out shortly, and there are a couple of my drawings inside. So I'm kind of doing visual art in books, and then I've had New Letters has published some of my drawings, and so I do watercolors and collages and drawings with ink and sometimes pen and ink, and and pencil depends on my mood. And every once in a while I venture into acrylics or oil, but mostly I like kind of the, to me, those other, well, collage isn't portable because, you know, but I just like the tactility of making collages. And but watercolor and drawing is very portable. You don't have to kind of, you know, set a whole bunch of things up. You can just, you know, do it. And so that sort of makes it possible for me to make more. And because I've done so many watercolors and some gouaches and so much drawing, it's become a kind of a habit. And then every once in a while I'll take out, I have a large collection of art papers and wrapping papers and stuff like that, and I'll take it out and I'll start making a mess with glue and scissors and scraps of paper. So that's
can the audience,
my visual art. Yeah.
Can the audience see any of these online?
Well, yes. I have some on my Facebook page, and you can see some on my blog, which is alikibarnstone.blogspot.com, and I'm rebuilding my website, but there are some on my website, which is alikibarnstone.com, but the new website is going to be updated, and there will be more samples of my visual art. So, yes.
Okay. Terrific. You've received many awards, including the Fulbright Fellowship that we mentioned before, but the one that introduced me, that interests me the most is your current position as State Poet Laureate. How are you selected? Is there a position you apply for? Are you nominated for it? How does that work?
Well, there was an application process for previous Poets Laureate. They just kind of called me up out of the blue and said that they wanted me to apply. And they said that they had already reviewed my work. And so I applied and I got it. I'm not exactly sure how it happened. I know that the first poet laureate of Missouri, Walter Bargan, would say to me, we really need to have a woman poet laureate. You should really apply. And so he might have, you know, kind of dropped some hints or done a little pushing when Governor Nixon was in power, and his wife Georgiana was very interested in literacy and so on. And I did write her a couple of emails saying how important I thought that poetry was and for literacy and learning, which is borne out by studies that poetry helps in every aspect of writing, reading, language fluency, and so on. Which doesn't surprise me at all. So I don't know if it was how exactly it happened, but it happened. So I'm happy about that. And
I agree.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I'm also the first poet laureate who is a professor at the University of Missouri at Columbia. That I think is also important, and I don't know if there was some significance to that since the University of Missouri has been under siege. So for me to be poet laureate, I think is helpful on some level because I do teach at the University of Missouri and I can kind of be a representative or an advocate. In my small way. I mean, I believe that you just do the little thing that you can do. And maybe if enough people do that, you know, little things too, then it adds up to something big. And that's my hope is that I can, you know, just plant some seeds here and there, and some of them will grow. And then I'm not the only person who's doing it, thank goodness. So I was very devastated when Pete Seeger died. And one of the things that he said, well, he said a lot of things about everybody doing something small, but he used a metaphor that I thought was interesting, that there's a teeter-totter, and in one basket are the huge boulders that the corrupt and the oppressors put in there, and there are all these other people who are resisting and working for the common good and so on, and they're putting teaspoons of sand into the basket, and some of the grains, you know, flow out the holes of the basket. But if enough people keep doing it, eventually the sand becomes heavier than the boulders.
I
just love this. What? Isn't that wonderful? So I just think that we all, you know, when we talk about all the things that are going wrong right now and the people who are truly evil, who are already harming people, I think that if enough of us show up and show up often and do our little thing, that that's the hope that's gonna help us to overcome.
I agree completely about the value of poetry and the importance of getting it to people being educated. I've been pushing for a few years for it to get to be the poet laureate in my town, me. And you know, I've volunteered to do these things, and I keep being told, yes, that's wonderful, but nothing ever happens. So I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Do they have that position?
No, they don't. So, you know, so I want to create it, and I want
to
do it.
That
but,
would be a
know.
Really awesome thing to create. It gives somebody, whoever holds that position, it gives them an opportunity to go into the community and to not, it's not just that the honor that I have for my own work. It's that I am in a position to honor others. And I think that's the best of it. I think that poetry in and of itself is valuable and transformative. Writing it, people reading it, people hearing it, but I was so touched by how much the students and their families were honored to have me honoring them, but to have me show up to hear their children recite poetry. It made me see how you can offer support in ways by virtue of such a position. You can go into the schools and the students and the teachers are honored, and then you can, and you honor them because they've honored you. So it's a namaste moment.
Yeah, that's what I want to do is to go into the high schools and the junior high schools and try to whip up interest. Do you have the fixed term, or how long is the would you be poet laureate
for?
2 years, you know?
But the last poet laureate, Bill Trowbridge, had a 4-year term. So I don't know how this is. We'll see. I think I have a feeling. Well, I don't know. I don't know. We'll see what happens. I think that I'm pretty much for the time being, I'm being ignored by the governor and the legislature in Missouri. That might be a good thing.
You might point out to the next governor that John Kennedy's inauguration was known for Robert Frost reading a poem, and that you should be up on the stage.
I don't know how I would have felt about doing that for the current administration. I campaigned really hard, knocked on many doors for Chris Koster, and I was really, really sad when he was defeated by just a few points. It was a very narrow defeat. And so anyway, I know I should just say, hey, that would be great. And it would have been great, but I've been pretty much, you know, they've pretty much ignored me, and that's okay. That's fine, because other people are that might. I keep on thinking that the fact that they don't pay attention to me gives me freedom. Because if they did pay attention to me, they might start to. I mean, I don't say anything about the Missouri. Well, I just did say some things about the Missouri legislature, but I don't say anything about the governor. I certainly not when I'm. I mean, I'm talking. It's unlikely that people in Missouri are going to hear this interview. But I try my best to be political without being overt about it, if that makes any sense. Because I think that there are ways of reaching people, like, for example, talking about the importance of public school when I was a child for me, and the importance of the arts and how it's it helps kids be strong and excel. And so there are things that you can say that where you're on common ground with people, there are things that are incontrovertible. Like, for example, most parents, you know, the vast majority of parents are proud of their kids and want the best for their kids. It's not universal, but sadly, but it should be. And so I'm trying really hard just to kind of be careful with regard to my public appearances among parents and kids in Missouri, if we're not in Columbia, because Columbia is a different story. I am not at all, I'm not a person who could go at this point in my life. I might have at other points in my life who can try to talk reason with people who approve of what's going on in our nation right now. I think that maybe eventually I will get to that point, and I think that I've come up with this idea. I think we need an army of young people. We need to train an army of young people to go door to door and talk to people. 'Cause young people are more, they're more open-minded than old people.
They're more energized too.
They're more energized too. I mean, it's not that I did go door to door campaigning, and it was really hard for me to do. It's just, you know, the shy girl comes out, knock on a stranger's door, and even though I was basically just saying, do you have any questions? And, you know, you're a registered Democrat. I was only going to registered Democrat stores. But there were a few moments that were really uncomfortable for me. but I think young people, you know, I think that if young people went door to door in these rural communities and said, how are you getting your health insurance? I mean, we just need a change of language, right? I mean, a lot of the people who are benefiting from the Affordable Care Act don't know that it's the same thing as Obamacare. So, you know, that's a little bit, again, you know, that's problematic in terms of language and having an informed populace that can make decisions about who they vote for based on an understanding of basic understanding of policy. So anyway, I kind of veered off from poet laureate, but I guess my sort of practice environment is going to places that where I don't know the community at all, and just talking about poetry and seeing what happens, and trying to be diplomatic in the way I approach things at the same time that I'm advocating for the arts. So
under the different administration, could the next step be poet laureate of the United States? There's only 49 other ones.
I don't know. I don't know how that. I have no idea how that happens. I have not got a clue how that happens. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I think that doesn't. We need a poet laureate no matter whose administration it is. So I'm poet laureate in a state whose administration I have passionate disagreements with. I don't even know if you could call them disagreements. I think that they're harming. They are attempting to harm our university and our public school system.
And the environment and a whole bunch of other
right,
stuff.
Right, right.
But that would take that would take us all night. We've covered a lot of ground tonight. What else would you like the audience to know about Kiki Barnes?
Well, let's see. I have three dogs and two cats.
Okay.
I have a wonderful daughter, Zoe, who's a sophomore at Mount Holyoke, and I'm married to Craig Cones, who's a builder. And what else? I don't know. Ask me a question.
Okay.
I'm really concerned with the environment, among other things. You know, I've raised a lot of concerns about a lot of things, but actually, the environment and refugees are this. This is one thing I would like to say. So I am really deeply concerned about the refugee crisis, and we have another refugee crisis. You know, we have the refugee crisis in the Middle East and Northern Africa, and then we have the refugee crisis and on this, our southern border, because there are a lot of people who are not coming into this country so that they can work, but they're coming into this country so that they can live. But one of the things that seems to be unknown is that climate change is one of the factors involved in the refugee crisis, and it will be the factor if we don't act. All of the coastal cities will be affected with water rising. We've already seen what happens when the water rose in New Jersey and New York. So the statistic is that 1 in 30 people, I believe it is, if we do nothing, will be a refugee in the whole world. So this is a crisis of incredible magnitude. And of course, the wars are driving people from their homes. But when I was in Greece, one of the women I talked to was a farmer. There's a really interesting article in Scientific American, and there are lots of articles about this, but the one in Scientific American explains how in Syria the drought has lowered the water table so much that people can no longer drill for water, and so they can't farm. And so this woman was a farmer, She was not fleeing the war, although I'm sure that that was a contributing factor. So this is what my great concerns is with the refugees. My mother's family were refugees during the, because of the population exchange between Turkey and Greece. So they, when my mother was 3 months old, they were thrown out of, they were deported from Turkey. And I think that that's one reason why the Greek people really deserve the Nobel Peace Prize, because Greece has been so welcoming to the refugees, unlike any place else. Germany looked really good for a little while there. The untold story about Germany and refugees is they need the labor force. But quite apart from that, they did try for a while, but now the borders are closed and more refugees are still landing in Greece and they're locked in to Greece, which is a country that is increasingly more poor because of the economic crisis. The Greeks are, the children are being educated in the public schools, and I mean, it's not perfectly rosy, but it certainly is a different attitude than the attitude that you see other places. And it is absolutely criminal that this country is keeping refugees out. It really is a replay what happened in the Holocaust. So
that's not too strong a statement, and I agree with that.
So I guess that in addition to, you know, loving animals and my family, I love the earth and I love people I don't know, and we all should. And I believe that most of us do. I think there are some people who are ruled by other things. One of them is fear, another is ignorance. And I think that most people understand that we'll open their doors and open their hearts when they're confronted with a real person. But I guess the abstraction of people getting on dangerous boats with their babies, because that seems like a better, like they have a better chance of living if they do that than if they stay where they are. I think that people can't quite, some of them, not all of them, can't quite relate. They don't relate to losing their homes. And fleeing their nation because they're going to be killed or starved to death.
Well, they did early in the 20th century with the Depression and the Dust Bowl and all that, and people migrating within the United States. But we've lost that. We've lost that need. Thank you very much, Kiki. It's been a real pleasure.
It's been a pleasure to talk to you too. We've covered so much territory. I'm overwhelmed in a good way.
Good.
Thank you. You asked really good questions, and it was lovely to talk to you.
Thanks again. A bit of commercial information. My books are available at Amazon. My blog, at medium.com, and published the daily paper mentioned earlier. Send any questions or comments to me about the show to johnmack13@gmail.com. And in the words of the Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, after the Mets win, put it in a book. I hope you'll join us next week for my interview with Jennifer Dorn, and every week at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday evening. Okay, Henry Mancini, take us off.
Thanks so
much. Henry's not being queued up. So thank you, everybody, and good night.
Good night.
And I will.